the dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
This is the voice of John Barber at John Barber's World here in Las Vegas, Nevada. The first voice you heard was that of my wife, Saria, singing with one of the great jazz guitarists in the world. His name was Joe Pass, and he cut a couple of wonderful albums with Ella Fitzgerald. The second voice you heard was probably the second greatest entertainer of the last century next to the Beatles. That was Francis Sinatra. He took over the Tonight Show one evening, and I was fortunate enough to be the first person he'd invited as a guest because I'd been doing a lot of work for Francis for a couple of years. And ordinarily, at the top of my show, I like to give voice to some observations about what's been going on in the country and in the world. We have the recent rulings by the Supreme Court after all this time legalizing or constitutionalizing gay marriage around the country. And I happened to, just by accident, see a couple out on the beach, a same-sex couple being married by a universal church minister. And the guy was all flustered. He really didn't know what he was saying or doing. And I got to wondering, now that it's legal, what will ministers and rabbis be saying at the end of the ceremony? I now pronounce you man and man, or I now pronounce you wife and wife. And anyway, there's so much to talk about, but I want to forego that because I'm really more interested in listening to the voices of our two guests, except I will tell you, it is June the 29th. And June is not busting out all over in Las Vegas. It is baking out all over. It's 114 degrees here. How hot is it? It's so hot, Jehovah's Witnesses are making phone calls. But in any event, I am a huge fan of mystery writers, all the way from Agatha Christie to Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, John le Carré, Scott Turow, James Patterson, and I have the complete works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, whose Sherlock Holmes once said, quote, "When you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, how improbable must be the truth." And that, to me, is the most apt way I can think of to introduce a really interesting, intriguing, informative, and at times very entertaining book called, quote, "And I Suppose We Didn't Go to the Moon Either." Is that a great title? It's deeply researched, very readable, a compendium of events and people we were told were true, but indeed may not be, all the way from the moon landing to the Beatles and beyond. It's compiled by a widely recognized writer-researcher who certainly knows his stuff, recognized around the world as one of the best in his field, James Fetzer, of whom I'm a huge fan, and a man, I'm sad to say, I just learned about by reading his very moving introduction to this book. He's a lifelong newspaper man and author himself of over a 24 books, both fiction and nonfiction. His name is Mike Palachek. Mike and James, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being here.
John, we're delighted.
James, you're first.
I'm just delighted to be here, John. I want to say Mike is, in my opinion, a homespun genius in the tradition of Garrison Keillor and Mark Twain. He had the vision for a series, Save the World, Resist the Empire, of which this is the second of a projected four-volume set, and my hat is off to him.
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to having Mike here, and as I mentioned, I was really moved by the introduction. I was stunned by it, and I guess partially because I recognize so much of myself and others in that introduction. But as for you, James, I must tell you, not only do I marvel at your knowledge, I absolutely marvel at your energy and your enthusiasm. I mean, you may not know it, but Lake Mead is what powers Las Vegas, and it's gone down 100 feet this year. It's half of what it was when I came here 20 years ago. But I have no concerns about that because I'm sure they'll figure out some way to stick a plug in you because you could power the whole city. Anyway, again, thank you. I'm going to set you aside for just a minute while I chat very briefly with Mike. Mike, again, thank you for being here. And the question that I have for you, I guess, Mike, and please forgive me, you know, I read literally hundreds of books all the time. I read stuff on the internet all the time, and I like to stay informed. So I am really sorry I had not heard from you, about you. But I was stunned by the sincerity of the introduction to this book. And I guess I suppose we didn't go to the moon either. And what I'd like to ask you first off is, could you tell us in a few minutes a little about that introduction and how you went from a curious, reserved young man to this very readable radical?
Well, I don't know how to put it, but I grew up in Norfolk, Nebraska, a small town. It was the hometown of Johnny Carson. And, you know, when you grow up in Norfolk, Nebraska, you grow up believing everything. You believe the Norfolk Daily News. You believe the Omaha World Herald. You believe the priests. You believe the sisters. You believe whatever you're told. But I guess I had the good fortune to when I got older, I decided I wanted to join the seminary. And when I went to join the seminary in St. Paul, I went to a bigger city, and my eyes were open. And one thing that happened there was Father Daniel Berrigan came to speak in St. Paul. And of course, being from Norfolk, Nebraska, I had never heard of him. But some other seminarians said no.
This was at the height of the Vietnam War and the protests?
Well, no, this would be in 1979.
Oh, okay.
So Berrigan is coming to St. Paul in 79, and I've graduated from college at this point, but I'm going into the seminary at the College of St. Thomas. And so Berrigan is, yeah, he's been through all his being on the cover of Time magazine and whatever. But I had never heard of him, but I went there to hear him speak. And after he spoke at McAllister College, I approached him and I asked him if he'd come over to the seminary to visit with us. And he did. And I got to know him, and he invited us out to Washington for protests there during Holy Week. But what Dan Berrigan was able to do for me was to open my eyes to the church, to America, to questioning everything. And I just think I was so lucky to have the chance to meet Dan Berrigan.
Excuse me a second, Mike. I must tell you, he was also lucky to meet you, because Berrigan had the opportunity to speak to 300 million Americans, and their eyes were not opened by listening to Daniel Berrigan, but your eyes were. So there must have been something inside of you that was very receptive to those truths.
I was very curious. I wanted to know, you know, I want to know all these things. I wanted to know, is, you know, about about God, about the church, about America, and, you know, and I just a sponge. And being in the, I guess, being in a the city, it just opened it up, and I had the, finally the chance to do that. And I ended up, well, I went, ended up going to prison myself for a protest at Offutt Air Force Base. And then I pursued a newspaper. Offutt is the command and control center of the America's nuclear weapons. So they don't have them there on the base, but they have the command and the control of them. So what we would do is we would, there'd be a white line, and we would cross the line. Very symbolic. We cross the line. We and then you do you wait a while, and maybe you go to court. And I ended up doing five relatively short prison sentences. But and then after I got out of jail, I had a, you know, it's just jail is in prison is a tough go. And I just just couldn't do it anymore. So I went into newspaper business, and I was very very idealistic about newspapers. I thought that was where I could really say my say. And it was, I found out, you know, it depends on advertising whether you can say your say. And after I started writing novels in 1994, and I've continued till today.
What was, for you, getting to the realm of nonfiction, what for you was the very first major national trauma that you questioned that made you change your mind about what you were hearing from the government and the media?
Well, that's a good one, because I believed everything for so long. I don't know when I started to wonder about the JFK assassination. Maybe it was when I first heard of Jim Fetzer. I don't know. I've been listening to Jim's radio shows for a long time, and he and Kevin Barrett and James Tracy, and I don't know exactly, to tell you the truth, because for a long time it was Green Bay Packers, New York Yankees, and America and everything.
Okay, you know, I'll ask James. James, when was the first time you met Mike? And James, you answered that question that I just posed to Mike. What was the first major event nationally in your life that made you question what the government and the media was telling us?
Well, you know, John, a lot like Mike, I grew up believing in my country, believing in my government, believing in our newspapers. I was commissioned in the Marine Corps on graduation, served 4 years, and resigned my commission as a captain to enter graduate school, earn a PhD in the history and the philosophy of science. That whole time, I'd been anchored out in Kaohsiung Harbor, Taiwan, when JFK was shot. I was awakened by the officer of the deck at 3:30 in the morning to tell me he'd been shot. An hour later, 4:30, to tell me they'd caught the guy who did it. He was a communist. I thought then that was pretty fast work. Today I know, of course, exactly why. But it was not until actually 1992 when I discovered that the editor-in-chief of the Journal of the American Medical Association was abusing his position to assail everyone who'd ever done serious work on the assassination of JFK, from Harold Weisberg and Mark Lane to David Lifton and Robert Grodin, and here is attacking a physician who'd actually been present in trauma room number one, Charles Crenshaw, and then 2 days later was responsible for the care of his alleged assailant. He was attacking Oliver Stone's film JFK, which I recognized as a masterpiece, and had it not been for the work of the then czar of Hollywood, who'd been Lyndon Johnson's right-hand man, in working against it, it would have won the Academy Award for Best Picture, which it so clearly deserved.
Do you mind if I interject something here? Because it's really interesting that you say, both Mike and you say, you believed in the American dream. You, of course, have heard of Mai Brussel, who was probably one of the first really widely recognized researchers after Mark Lane to talk about the assassination. Well, she was the daughter of the founder of I. Magnin Department Store, a Beverly Hills housewife with a few children. She paid no attention to it when Oswald was shot. Like you, she believed everything. She got very suspicious a couple of days later when Oswald was shot by Ruby. And that's when she became this terrific researcher. And of course, Jim Garrison, like both you and Mike, said he always believed the government. He always believed the Warren Report. And when I interviewed him in 1980 for 3.5 hours, when it was over, I said, "Mr. Garrison, you're very conservative. You're not aligned to any political party. You were the first person to hire women in the district attorney's office. You refused to prosecute Jane Baldwin for the fire next time because of the First Amendment. You're a former FBI agent, and you were a colonel, for crying out loud, in the Air Force. What made you ever think you could take on the federal government?" And it's as though you and Mike were speaking. He said, "John, I guess as a kid, I saw one too many Frank Capra movies." And I agree with you about Oliver Stone's film. Had Oliver Stone's film not been made, The Last Word on the Assassination with the Garrison tapes could have never been made, because it just lingered in my vaults for 10 years until we finally had the chance to do it. Now, when was the first time you met Mike, and how did you begin to work together?
I think Mike and I actually met for the first time in Duluth, where I had taught for not quite 20 years before my retirement in 2006, after which I'd moved near Madison, Wisconsin, where I've been devoting myself to all of these complex and controversial issues of our time, and the belief that someone with a kind of technical background and abilities I developed over 35 years of offering courses in logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning just might make a difference. And Micah somehow, I mean, it astonishes me to this day, decided that Kevin Barrett, with whom I'd done a radio show for a year and a half entitled The Dynamic Duo, where he was on Monday and Friday and I was on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and we've continued to make efforts of our own on independent radio shows and in collaboration today with a False Flag Weekly News every Thursday morning on No Lies Radio, he somehow perceived us as representative of a resistance movement in the United States for which I've been eternally indebted. I mean, he produced this book, John. It was like a phone book. I mean, you know, not a small one. I mean, maybe not quite South Central L.A., but I mean a big book. And I was just so touched and flattered by Mike and his sincerity and dedication and intelligence that I've been thrilled to be collaborating with him ever since.
When did you guys get together to put this compendium together? And what was the story that prompted you to do it? I mean, were you just going to do one story or two stories? Or did this whole thing grow out of one of the, or two of those stories?
Well, Mike had the vision, so I want him to elaborate upon it. But the idea of creating a series that would have the daring title, Save the World, Resist the Empire, was his genius, for which I'm, again, eternally in his debt. Mike.
Mike, go ahead.
Well, you know, in preparing for this, I went back, Jim, and I looked at the emails we were talking about this. It was December of 2013 when we started talking about this, and I suggested that I just thought there should somewhere be a catalog of all these false flag events. And I shot off an email to Kevin Barrett and Jim just to see what they thought, and they thought positively of it. And then we started to shoot the ideas back and forth, and we thought of people who might want to contribute to it, and it just went on for there. It's really been, well, it's been a kind of a long haul, but it was worth it to finally get this book out. There was supposed to be there will be another one, but there was supposed to be one to precede this, but this, you know, it's going to work out.
John, when you hear the title of the second book in the series, you'll understand why this title was so appropriate, because the book that was delayed in publication and now actually will be much stronger because of intervening events was to be entitled and will be Nobody Died at Sandy Hook.
Well, it's a stunning title, but I must tell you, this one is very, very intriguing because it's sort of the reaction somebody who'd had a few beers might have if they were sitting at a bar with you and you were telling them the story about the moon landing, about Paul McCartney or Saddam Hussein, and then the guy pops up and says, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either.
I mean, know.
It's just so appropriate. But the moon landing is the first portion of your book, and why did you focus on that first?
Well, it seems such a, you know, an enormous hoax. In other words, there have been many of lesser scale, but this book was intended to focus on some of those that have been truly gargantuan and historic in their influence. I became intrigued with the moon landing in London in 2001, where I had been there the year before to give the keynote address to the British Society for the Philosophy of Science at the London School of Economics, and I knew my wife and daughter would love London. So I brought Jan over, and because her maiden name was Morgan, I picked the Morgan Hotel when I discovered it on Bloomsbury Street, which backs up to the British Museum. And we were in our room watching a BBC channel when what should come on but conspiracy theory, did we land on the moon? And I, because of my background in the history and philosophy of science, was captivated by argument after argument that was rooted in science, the difficulties created by the Van Allen radiation belt.
Was this only a British production? It was not seen in the United States. It was shown originally in England.
Oh, you can now find it on the internet, in fact, John, and it's a wonderful production, but primarily it captivated me because it was rooted in science. And in fact, you know, it's fascinating that as recently as just a couple of years ago, NASA announced that the principal objection, the principal problem to traveling to Mars was Van Allen radiation. Which is rather
What exactly is a Van Allen belt? And
it's a huge accumulation of particles left over from the creation of Earth that constitutes like a ring of Saturn. It's a belt between Earth and Moon, and it represents a tremendous gravitational field. But it's been there as long as Earth, or about 4.5 billion years, which means that if it's a problem now with planning a trip to Mars, it obviously was a problem in the late 1960s when we purportedly traveled to the moon repeatedly with no problems whatsoever. Well, in fact, we just had a rocket blow up, John. I mean, I'm telling you, talk about our incapacity to master space. Gus Grissom, who would be dry roasted in what was supposed to be an accident but appears to have been a deliberate murder in a space capsule during a training op, had hung a lemon over his desk because he thought the whole operation was hopeless, that the moon lander couldn't even be operated successfully in the six times greater gravitational field of the Earth, and it therefore would be virtually impossible to control in the much weaker gravitational field of the moon, and he was taken out. I'm convinced of that.
James, what about items like the Hubble telescope or the shots that they sent out through space to circle Mars and photograph Mars? They got through the Van Allen belt, didn't they?
Oh, sure, but those aren't manned missions, John. I'm not talking about...
I see what you're saying. Oh,
yeah, yeah. And what you would expect would be done is in the normal progression of science, you take... You know, lesser forms of life. I don't know if you'd begin with lab rats, but certainly monkeys, whatnot, to see if they could traverse and survive the Van Allen radiation belt. I think it would have been already obvious they could not, and therefore sending human beings to the moon was going to be an impossibility. It's fascinating too, John, when you go back to the father of rocket science, Wernher von Braun, who was brought into the United States with a lot of other high-ranking Nazi scientists and military intelligence officers during Operation Paperclip. He initially designed a spacecraft to travel to the moon. It was three times the size of the Empire State Building, and he suggested we'd need several of them if we were going to be serious about it.
Didn't they indeed send monkeys out into space at one time?
Not to my knowledge, John. I mean, it's an intriguing question because it would be what should have been done. But I'll tell you, there's pretty much a consensus, I believe, that those spacesuits actually were costumes. I mean, we have a chapter here by Jay Widener revealing how Stanley Kubrick appears to have filmed the moon landing footage on a stage for which he was provided financing to make his magnificent 2001 A Space Odyssey using what's known as front screen projection, which is easily recognizable because distant features are just as in focus and clear as our foreground features, which is impossible with the normal optics of photography.
Yeah, I read James' stuff on Kubrick because I was an absolute huge fan of Stanley Kubrick's. And so after reading for about the second or third time his really interesting essay and investigation into Kubrick's faking the moon landing, when I went to see The Shining, I took these notes, and I was watching for the stuff that he pointed out in the film. And indeed, the stuff is in the film. So, you know, it's
Jay is really a fascinating guy with broad knowledge, including of Hollywood inside and out. But I think the most stunning chapter on the moon is by Winston Wu, where we have 35 proofs we didn't go to the moon. This is a really interesting guy who has what he calls his trilogy, conspiracy trilogy report online about JFK 9/11 and the moon landings. And I like what he did so well that I incorporated and refined it for the purpose of the book.
Well, it's wonderful. It's absolutely a terrific read. Okay, so now you see this conspiracy theory on British television, and you decide to look into it. And you look into it, and you come to the same conclusion that this little documentary showed you, because it's based on scientific fact. What happened to you when you spoke up publicly for the first time in the United States about we didn't go to the moon?
Well, believe it or not, John, this book is probably really the first time I've declared myself on the moon landing, because while I accumulated videos and studies about the moon, it didn't become a pressing issue for me until we got serious about doing this particular volume. I mean, I was personally convinced that we had not gone. But to prove it, I solicited, you know, contributions from four different experts. And that has really made it fall together. And beyond them, of course, we have all kinds of other evidence. I mean, it really is one of what they describe as a gift that keeps on giving, because the more you look into it, the more obvious it becomes. Including, for example, the photographs from the moon are all clear and perfectly focused, John. Well, the cameras were mounted on the outside of the spacesuits, and even the astronauts couldn't frame them. So it's astounding. We have this incredible number of photographs. In fact, friend of mine from JFK Research by the name of Jack White became interested in moon photography and would show me one of his studies after another where they had the source of light too close to the stage, for example, so that shadows were being cast in obviously different directions, which would be impossible if the only source had been the sun, because of its immense distance from the moon, all shadows would have been cast uniformly in the same direction. And where Jack eventually did a simple quantitative argument by counting up the number of photographs that were taken from the six different trips to the moon and the amount of time, where he observed that if the agency, he's talking about NASA now, and I'm quoting him, the agency wants the world to believe that 5,771 photographs were taken in 4,834 minutes. If nothing but photography had been done, such a feat is clearly impossible, made even more so by all the documented activities of the astronauts. Imagine 1.19 photos every minute that men were on the moon. That's one picture every 50 seconds.
Well, we're going to take a quick break right now, James. And when I come back, I want to start off by asking Mike a question about, did he believe we went to the moon? How much convincing did he take? And has there ever been anything said by any of the astronauts that would lead you to believe that they were relieving themselves of this horrible lie that they'd lived all these years? We'll be right back with Mike and James right after this.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film, based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Now the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere, sunny one so true, I love you.
Thank you, Doc. Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
I'd like to thank George Knapp for that wonderful unsolicited review on The Last Word on the Assassination. George, as you know, is the best host of Coast to Coast AM. He does it on Sunday nights. And if you want to see some more just fabulous unsolicited reviews, if you go to Amazon and Google it, you can read them. They're just wonderful. And there are a lot of them also by some very famous folk. And while you're up there, if you want a kind of an entertaining and fun read, you could buy John Barber's first uncensored Facebook book. And you can open it at any page and be laughing or insulted or angry or inspired. It's sort of chicken soup for the funny bone, with a great introduction by James Beltzer. So give that a peek. Anyway, we're back now with James Fetzer and Mike Palachek, who just put together this absolutely wonderful book called And I Suppose We Didn't Go to the Moon Either. And Mike, we're coming back to you with a question I posed before the break. When did you begin to change your mind about the moon landing, or did you always question it? And was there ever anything revealed in interviews, public or private, by any of the astronauts who seemed to indicate that it had all been a fraud? Mike.
Well, John, I think I remember watching a YouTube or reading something by Bart Sobrell that started me thinking this way. And also, the thing that I go back to is the YouTube presentation of the press conference when Aldrin and Armstrong and Collins supposedly came back from the moon. And what I look at is their, as many people do, is their demeanor, their body language. They just don't look like, hey, we just came back from the moon and it was pretty great. They look like, I've got something to hide and I'm so depressed and we're hoping we have our story together. And I just, you know, if you look at that YouTube presentation, it's got to cause you to wonder what horror these guys were going through at the time.
You know what what it sort of reminds me of is the first time that I became suspicious, I must say, of the John Kennedy assassination was when Lyndon Johnson arrived at night and disembarked from Air Force One and had to read from a piece of paper how bad he felt about the murder of John Kennedy. And I thought, my God, the guy just can't ad-lib his sorrow. And that's when I became intrigued in it. Do you think that any of the astronauts' wives were ever confided to?
Well, I have no idea. I have no idea. But I would imagine, yes. I mean, families go through these things together. I mean, it would be a terrible burden, I think. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, well, let's say they are lying, but just think of a whole life of having to do that, and to think of an extended family that has to be involved in that.
And Stanley Kubrick's wife. It seems to me that Stanley was a kind of person who would have had his wife know about what it was that he was doing.
Yeah, and the pressure that can be brought to bear by these people, the CIA, the FBI. I've just had a little taste of it myself a long time ago in federal prison, but it gives you an indication that these guys are serious. They're serious people, and that they can put all kinds of pressure on you. And that's just what I feel when I see that this press conference
That was a conspiracy that involved the government, and there were probably some fatalities involved along the way, and it was probably a very dangerous thing to conspire in. And that's the first part of the book. Well, part of the book that I really enjoyed reading immensely, even though I'm not sure that I can agree with the conclusions that you and Mike and the authors of the articles that you have in there, just brilliant articles, especially Anonymous, about the Italian newspaper people who decided they were going to look into the death of Paul McCartney and prove it that it was all a fraud, and they came to a different conclusion that he indeed died. I mean, that to me is a harmless conspiracy, but two reasons I find it difficult to believe, even though I loved the reading of it. You have two or three pages of all these hints that are put in there in the liner notes and in the music of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Club Hearts Band. I mean, it's just fabulous reading, and it's really intriguing and extremely believable. But two things. First of all, John Lennon, who was the brightest of all the Beatles, the most humane, the most politically involved, the most socially involved, who had the courage and the foresight to say, truthfully, the Beatles had more influence than Jesus ever had, which is indeed true, but he had this great sense of humor, so it wouldn't surprise me that he knew of all these rumors that were floating around after the supposed car crash and included all that. But let's say the Beatles did conspire, the surviving Beatles did conspire to keep this a secret. The man who supposedly took his place had a family and a group of friends. And he just disappeared. Well, where did he disappear to? And why would they be silent about that? So Could we address that first?
Sure, John. Yeah, I'm pleased to. What has astonished me the most about this is how quickly they were able to replace Paul, who appears to have died on 9/11, coincidentally, of 1966. And
okay,
what
now,
appears
a quick question. If he died in a motor crash in 1966, would there not have been a newspaper article and BBC news reports about this crash and this death?
Well, it appears Brian Epstein was able to keep it quiet. It was a rather grisly accident. He left the studio after an argument with John. It was raining heavily. He picked up a young woman whose middle name was Rita, who was so excited at being in the car with Paul. She distracted him. He ran a light. He was hit from the side and ran into a telephone pole. She got out, but the car burst into flames, and Paul was trapped and was calling out, "Get me out, get me out," when he burned to death. And the fact is that because of his disfigurement from the fire, most people didn't actually have any idea who it was. I mean, because it was a rainy night anyway, there weren't a lot of people out in the kind of crowd that might otherwise have gathered.
What happened to this Rita, since she was the witness to it?
Well, that's an interesting question all by itself, but it appears the key player in all of this was the family of the Ashers, a very prominent British family, because Paul was engaged to Jane Asher.
That's right.
As you notice from the back photograph, I put a pair of complimentary pictures, one of Paul with Jane, the other of Fall, and of course Fall, F-A-U-L, is used for false Paul or his replacement, who's a half a head taller. One of many of the indications that we're talking about two different people. I appreciated your allusion to anonymous scholar who provided me with an English translation of the article in Wired Italia, which was the Italian version of Wired magazine, which came out virtually the same day that Sir Paul or Fall went on with David Letterman to address rumors of his death. Mm-hmm. Which have many fascinating aspects to it. I mean, that very interview with David Letterman. But what I found in the Italian scientist's work was, as you observed, they set off to disprove the hypothesis there were two Pauls, to confirm there was only one. But in fact, they discovered they differed in their teeth, their palates. Paul had bad teeth, a narrow palate. Fall had good teeth, a larger palate. They differ in the size and shape of their skulls. I put that right on the cover. You got Paul on the left. He had a roundish, very boyish face. He had a lot of exuberance. Fall, the replacement, has a more oval, longer face. So we get songs about, boy, you let your head grow long. I mean, there are just so many musical clues in there, John. But the fact is that Fall...
there are tons of them, and they're certainly interesting to read about, but... The most difficult thing would have had to have found, two things are true. First of all, you're very right when you're pointing out before the supposed or the replacement of Paul with this Billy Shears, whatever his name was that every one of the Beatles always talked on camera, whether it was Ringo or George or Paul or John, whenever the cameras were on, each one of them spoke. Afterwards, only John spoke, and nobody else spoke. So it wonders. But the most difficult thing would have been to find somebody who was literally a musical genius.
Somebody who was capable of replacing. It was for that reason that until I encountered the forensic evidence, which established, to my mind, conclusively that we're talking about two different persons, I found it almost impossible to entertain the hypothesis seriously. About 2 years ago, I interviewed Tina Foster, who has a website, Plastic Mecca, which is devoted to research on this issue. And she gave a lot of good reasons for believing it. But while I was impressed by her reasoning, I wasn't convinced. It was only after I discovered the forensic evidence that the pieces fell into place. And where it turns out that, you know, apparently after Paul's death, Ringo raised the question, what about the band? And that, of course, was terribly weighty question. I mean, here was the most successful band in the world. They had all kinds of contracts and obligations. They had a huge number of fans. And Brian Epstein did this in a series of steps. Paul dies on 9/11 of September. In October, Brian announces to the astonishment of the world that the Beatles are no longer going to tour, offering the feeble explanation that they cannot hear themselves sing, which is as meaningless as possible because, you know, groups thrive on the adrenaline generated by their fans. And the following month already, they had someone they were beginning to introduce. I did a recent interview with Nicholas Kollerstrom, who, of course, contributed a marvelous chapter about this and who has his own book about Paul McCartney that's about or to be published. He's looking for a publisher, but I expect it will be very soon forthcoming, where Nick and I did 2 hours about this, and Nick had some slides of the replacement which didn't make the book, which are just wonderful, showing that he didn't really look all that much like Paul at all. And then in December, they featured him again, and where he had Mal Evans behind him, he was like the Beatles' manager, road manager, and he would, give Paul the answers if there were a question, you know, that he might not know how to respond to. And then you have the first group photograph, John, is taken in January, and it's very unusual because they have all these bright lights directed at the camera, so you really can't make out the features of the crowd. And, of course, Paul was wearing a mustache, never, you know, not a property of the Beatles heretofore. And then we get Sergeant Pepper in July, which is, in fact, a formal introduction of Billy Shears and the burial of the Beatles. You have a gravesite there. It says Beatles in red roses. You have Paul's left-handed guitar where you look carefully. It spells out Paul.
Okay, James, hang on just a second. You're a monumental, lifelong fan of the Beatles. There had to be some point, I mean, where you, in the beginning, you couldn't have believed it possible because you were such a fan of the Beatles. What made you change your mind? So take that question first. The second question is, if you Google the London Mirror and you Google Paul McCartney's death, they have 7 reasons why they call it a myth and why it continues. And they point out why the name Billy Shears was introduced into the album, the Sgt. Pepper album, and the business of the configuration and the roses. It seems that each one of the Beatles was allowed to pick something or someone to honor on the cover of that album. And this is what Paul McCartney picked. And I think it was somebody who had died in 1961 who had been a friend of his. If you Google that, it makes fascinating reading also. What was it that ultimately made you think this is true?
It was the forensic evidence, which I like so much, of course, and it's so powerful and important. I put it right in the book.
Yes.
So, if it weren't for the forensic evidence, we might be debating this endlessly, but there are these clear, conspicuous differences between them, John. No person can have, at approximately the same time, good teeth and bad teeth, a wide palate and a narrow palate, be one height and another height.
And the ear.
Even their ears are different. That's correct.
That's true.
But the other thing is, this became a very closely guarded secret, right? And even though many people had to know, Nick gave the wonderful story, for example, of Linda Eastman, who was a groupie for many of these popular bands and who had photographed the Beatles many times, who walked up to Paul and said to him, "I know you're not Paul. When did you join the band?" And she became a really loving and supportive and admiring person for Paul, just as Jane Asher had become a loving, supportive person for Paul. And I listened to, this was about a week or 10 days ago, they were having a retro perspective about Paul because his birthday was coming up. It's just come and pass, which is why Nick and I had the interview we had. And because my show is a video show now, as it became video this year, I was able to show these images. Wonderful. And the interview, the host was talking with Paul McCartney, and he made several remarks that were very odd. One was he said that he found the fans were very tolerant of mistakes, that he'd play a piece, and if he got some notes wrong, that the fans were very forgiving. And it occurred to me, well, Paul wouldn't say something like that. That's somebody who's trying to emulate Paul who would say something like that. And I thought that was revealing in and of itself. He also talked about Wings. He said when he did Wings, he did it in his style, not in the Beatles style. That was a very odd thing to say, too, because, of course, if he'd been among the founding members of the Beatles, he just wouldn't have said it that way.
Okay, now, by surest... Okay, two things. First of all, the business of his doing the Wings in his style. There was a Beatles style. There was a Beatles sound. John Lennon does not sound like somebody doing the Beatles when he does the individual songs that he does. And so Paul also has his own personality, so it's not entirely true that he would sound like the Beatles. So, and then the business of forgiveness. I watched, I don't mean to digress, but it is kind of important. I watched an unbelievable documentary last night about Glenn Campbell, who is getting Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And he says, "I'll be me." If you get a chance to watch it, it's an hour and a half, CNN. You can, if you get cable, you will be able to find it. And the man can't even find the way to his own bathroom in his own house. But you put a guitar in his hands, and he is like one of these kids that is born malformed and deformed, but is a brilliant mathematician or is a brilliant scientist or a brilliant musician. Well, Glenn Campbell, when he did that, he sang and he performed beautifully, but he made a lot of mistakes. And he said, and his son and daughter play with him, said the fans not only forgave him, they applauded and cheered when he did that.
Yes. So I love that. John, and I think you're a dear to be bringing these things up. Let me just say, it's a feature of a scientific hypothesis when it's true that you continue to get confirming evidence, even if from unexpected sources. In this case, some of the other students of this issue had already watched The Winged Beetle, which runs about 2.5 hours. It's all about Paul. And I say, I just watched The Winged Beetle yesterday by surest coincidence. And in that 2.5 hours, there's 5 minutes that is absolutely devastating. For example, there is Fall with the other members of the band talking about a certain way he wanted to play a song and saying, "Well, you guys, you lads, have played that before." And it's a remark that one would never have made had they been a member of the original band. Now, I tell you, if you go through this...
That's very true.
John, you go through this 2.5 hours, you'll find 5 minutes worth of absolutely fascinating stuff, including how, after they had made a trip to Africa where the replacement had had some plastic surgery, Mal Evans returned to Paul's home and fired his butler. This is his lifelong butler who would never see Paul McCartney again. He fired him for the obvious reason that he would have recognized immediately that this was not Paul McCartney, but a replacement. It's like when Saddam's wife went to visit Saddam under pressure from the Red Cross. She came out screaming, "This is not my husband. This is a double. What have you done with my husband?"
I remember that clearly. Okay, the quick question would be then, what about the family and friends of the McCartney replacement? How do they remain silent?
Well, it's very interesting is that, you know, how much family, how much friends he had. I mean, I can't identify the specifics, but Nick and I both agree that there's a publication out there called The Memoirs of Billy Shears that appears to be authentic in its origin, to have some falsified aspect because he's under some kind of legal or contractual obligation not to reveal the whole truth. But let me just mention, by the way, that James Larson, in his completely brilliant chapter on this issue, where he goes through 5 or 6 different candidates, comments on the name Billy Shears, which seems to be a variation, Billy, obviously, on William Shears.
I know where you're going. It's great.
Yeah, Shears, he suggests, is actually from Shakespeare, whose identity has also been disputed, and where Shakespeare used to sign his name only Spear. So you get from William Spear to Billy Shears, not that large a leap. And, you know, the Beatles really were fantastic with their literary allusions, symbolic and otherwise.
Well, I must tell you, I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed that portion of the book. First of all, give me some of the little notes that you have, two or three pages on little insights and comments or visuals about why Paul McCartney and how Paul McCartney was replaced. You got a couple of pages. Just give me a half a dozen of those, and then, because I also have the complete works of William Shakespeare, and I was a member of a British repertory company for a year in the 60s when I was in England, so I had to do it. So I love all that stuff, believe me. How it got from Billy Shears to William Shakespeare. I mean, it is a great read.
Well, let me just mention a couple points that may not be direct answers, John, because there are all these clues that are littered throughout the chapters in the book. But where Ringo recently observed that he was the only surviving Beatle, and he did that on an occasion when Paul, or Sir Paul, as he's also known, was present. And, you know, it's really kind of fascinating. Here's something from page 167. You all know that the only person around this table who can go is me. I was in the biggest rock and roll band in the history of music. I am the last remaining Beatle.
Yes,
the best jokes are based on truth. There is an element of truth in it, Ringo says, before pausing for thought. But I think it's possible on the outside who perceive Paul as thinking he's the only one left. Actually, it's me. I am the last remaining Beatle.
Yeah, they claim he said that as a joke, that it was found on a site called MACCA, M-A-C-C-A, which is supposed to be some kind of satirical site, and they claim that's where he originally made that comment.
John, when the truth comes out and you want to deny it, you'll suggest it was satire, it was a joke,
yes.
You didn't mean it. I mean, those are just obvious fallbacks, aren't they?
That's
so, you know, you have to put all the evidence together, and I say nothing is more decisive in this instance than the discovery that we're talking about two different people, where the Italian forensic scientists did their job. And remember, when Fall was on with Letterman, and Letterman pressed him on the replacement, he said, well, who was the replacement? And Fall said, putting his fingers on his chest, it's me.
That's funny. Now, and you know, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Band is just a phenomenal album. So obviously the music was not hurt by Paul's death and his supposed replacement, right?
No, it took a variation. It was different. And there are plenty of fans of the Beatles who noticed a significant difference beginning with Sergeant Pepper. And I'll just make one more point, John, that I'm sure you'll appreciate. In the band, the Resplendent Band, you have the original group in black, and then the Resplendent Band. And Paul is, of course, decidedly taller, and there's a hand above his head for the show must go on. And there are many other Beatle photographs and so forth where you find that hand representing showbiz above the head of Paul. Not the others, only Paul.
Well, I must tell you, James, I absolutely love the book. And again, like I say, it's like UFOs. I have two really good friends, Jeff Rentz and George Knapp. George Knapp is one of my best friends here in Vegas. Fabulous newsman who is into UFOs, as if Jeff Rentz. And as much as I read about it or listen to them, I still cannot wrap my head around it. I don't know why, but I just can't. But I must tell you, I found reading this, especially that chapter on the Beatles and then all of the other stuff. So I've got to ask Mike. Mike, you are obviously a fan of the Beatles. Did it take you much to be convinced that Paul was replaced, or are you convinced?
Well, I just have to say that I'm learning as I go, and I don't know everything about it, but my, I guess my big thing is we have to have the right to ask. We have to have the, there can't be any limits to inquiry about any of these things. And that's what I feel so strongly. And that's why I wanted to be a part of this. No, I'm not an expert on many of these things, and I don't know it all, but it's so important that we just have the right to ask and that we keep asking, because it just seems like in our society, there's just so many things we're not allowed to ask about.
Well,
so many things are true.
I must tell you, a democracy does not depend on our leaders answering questions. It depends upon our still being able to ask them. And like you, I'm still learning, and there's no one to learn better or more from than James Fetzer, because like Allstate, you're in very capable hands when you're in the hands of Professor James Fetzer. James, I want to thank you so much for being here. Mike, I want to thank you also, and I look forward to talking to you both again many, many times. Thank you again. Have a wonderful weekend.
Our great pleasure, John. You're a link to a glorious past.
Thank you.
Spark of nature's fire, you're my sweet, complete desire, a sunny, 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 sunny.